Hi there, and welcome to Online Gods, a podcast about digital cultures in India and beyond. This week, we're speaking with Victoria Bernal on digital diaspora politics, and with Rishi Bagri on being a right-wing Twitter superstar. Sometimes I wonder why I bother to engage in online debate. Not that I think it's pointless, but rather that I'm not very good at it. When I join in a conversation, people ignore me. It's so quiet, the sound of the computer fan and the mouse scroller is deafening. Now, it could be that my points are so bad that people just refuse to engage with them. Or it could be that my immense intelligence and wit is just too much for people to handle and they just don't know how to respond. Realistically, it's probably just that I've not learned how to do online discussion effectively. Well, on this month's podcast, we'll look into cases of really effective online communication, ones that have a real global reach. And why do we do this? Well, because every podcast, we're exploring how the shift to online media is changing the public sphere in India and beyond. This podcast is part of a wider project on digital dignity run by Sahan Udupa at LMU and is realised in collaboration with the How Network for Ethnographic Theory. This month, as every month, we'll speak with a scholar about a key concept, and then we'll speak with an online god, a person or an organisation who uses digital media in an influential or impactful way. Now, as I'm recording this podcast, the world seems to be in a collective shock that people in one country might be able, via the power of the internet, to influence the politics of people in another country. Well, I for one wasn't really surprised, and I doubt that as an audience as intelligent as your good selves were particularly surprised either. Because as we'll see in both of this episode's interviews, digital communication redefines how we think of borders, spheres of influence, and presumed interest. I live in Hungary, a country which gives me lots of reasons to get angry, and increasingly there are chances to turn that anger into political participation. And when I do get angry, mostly about the direction of politics and society, I do join in. But if I'm honest, I feel much more involved in the country of my birth, the UK, a country that I've hardly lived in for most of my adult life. And I wonder why. Why do I care so much? Why do I feel the need to join in political debates online, sometimes about pretty petty things? Well, someone who is well placed to answer that question is Victoria Bernal, a scholar who has spent a lot of time thinking about diaspora politics, specifically in regards to Eritrea and Eritreans. And luckily for us, she's now on the line. Hi, Victoria. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Ian. My pleasure. I'm coming to you from the studios of KUCI Radio at the University of California, Irvine.
Great. And you sound absolutely wonderful.
Thank you. Well, Victoria, since you can't see me, let me just say that I look absolutely wonderful, too.
What time? You're at 10 o'clock in the morning, but we're at 7 o'clock in the evening. I'm not looking as good as you, I can assure you. Luckily, there's no camera on this end. Victoria is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Irvine. And in regards to questions of diaspora, she has a bunch of really interesting journal publications, links of which I'm going to post on the website. And she also has a wonderful book, which came out in 2014, and which is called Nation as Network, Diaspora, Cyberspace, and Citizenship. She's also worked on gender and feminist theory, NGOs, and Islam, among other topics. But today, we'll be focusing on the internet, diaspora politics, and the public sphere. My first question is a big one. With the diaspora in mind, how is the internet changing the nation state?
Well, you know, one of the really interesting things is the compression of time and space that the internet makes possible so that people can participate in real time, basically, in the politics of places, even though they're far away from them. And I think that is a huge, there's a long, long history of diasporas and of people who identify with, places of their heritage or their birth and so on. but the ability to know in real time what's happening back in the home country and respond to it in some way in real time is really a new development that I think is a huge game changer. And this is not just from diasporas looking back toward their homeland, but also institutions and politicians in the homelands that realize now that they have a global audience that includes people of their diasporas abroad who often have a certain amount of influence and clout, because if we're talking about diasporas from the global south, the people outside the country often are wealthier than many of the population inside the country. And this is the case in Eritrea, where the state really works very hard to cultivate diaspora loyalty to the regime and seeks remittances and donations and actually taxes the diaspora. So I think it's a very interesting development in terms of the shifting relationship between, it's not even necessarily citizens, because not all diasporas are actually citizens of those countries, but people who I think of it as a kind of emotional citizenship, that they might not legally be citizens, but they feel that deep connection and concern about what's going on there.
And what were you getting at with the title of your book, Nation as Network?
I of course, like many anthropologists, I was interested in Benedict Anderson's idea of the nation as an imagined community. And I started thinking about how that, the way in which people engage with nations and nationalism would be changed by these two very powerful forces in the late 20th and early 21st century, migration and digital media. How are those two things in some ways, creating a synergy that that really changes the dynamic? And I thought about that idea, that basically that connection that's made possible through digital media means that cohabiting a territory or being located inside the sovereign territory of the nation is far less important to participating in its social and political life than it was before. So I started thinking about and the way in which diaspora itself is a network of people, often dispersed, but these dispersed members of communities and kin groups and so on create vibrant social networks that keep them in touch as a diaspora, as some kind of recognizing themselves as some form of common community, and then their ability to connect as diasporas among each other and then also back to the homeland.
Mm-hmm. And that all sounds quite quite positive. I was wondering, is there a way also then that the state probably wants to exercise control over its diaspora, like the state wants to control many of its citizens? Is it possible for the state to use the digital to, control the behavior of its diaspora?
Yeah. So states, we've seen that states are very interested in controlling their populations and controlling their diasporas in many ways. And they want to control people's access to the internet and what people are doing online. And it, of course, one of the exciting things about the internet is that it opened up new kinds of freedom of expression and freedom to organize that was often not possible for people to do in a country like Eritrea on the ground, where they would be surveilled and imprisoned and so on. There's that possibility that it's opened up, and then the states are making efforts to regain control and to restrict what people can do. And countries have done this in different ways, but one thing the Eritrean state allegedly does is using trolls to basically spout government views in online forums that Eritreans in diaspora created as a transnational political public sphere for Eritrean politics. So there's often viewpoints that people suspect are merely people, doing the government's job of spreading government propaganda. And these trolls also, attack and defame other people. People that have expressed some criticism, then they try to bring out negative things about them or accuse them of being, supporting Ethiopia or enemies of the government and so on and so forth. I mean, even I and a bunch of other Eritreanist scholars were subjected to a kind of online trolling where, somebody purported to be working at the behest of the government wrote a lot of bad things about us, that we're against Eritrea's sovereignty and so on and so forth. I mean, we've seen this, I was pretty shocked even to see in our own country the request by the Trump administration for all of the information from a website that had been used to organize demonstrations at the inauguration, at Trump's inauguration. They requested from that website the information about anybody who had gone on to that website. I mean, these are the kinds of things that create a very chilling effect for people seeking to participate and express themselves politically.
No, it is. It's extremely scary. And I suppose the key word there that you brought up was information. And it reminds me of a concept that I think it's in chapter one or chapter two of the book I mentioned that you raise, info politics. You know, you're talking about how information is so key for certain groups who wish to exercise power. So I was wondering, can you talk a little bit like what info politics means as a concept, like why information is so useful in diaspora politics or digital politics?
Yeah, well, I came up with that idea of info politics really because I felt that people were focusing, I mean, this was back when I started that research project, many years back, actually. And in sort of the initial enthusiasm around the internet was this idea that it was just this information superhighway, that it would just be this great fund of open source information in a way. And what I felt was that view of information as just some kind of resource floating out there did not fully account for the way that information is politicized and the management and control of information is such an important source of power. And the way that secrecy operates and censorship and all of these things, they didn't all go away just because we got the internet. So my concept of info politics was really an attempt to draw attention to the importance of the management of information, that it's not simply that people are fighting over the content of, you say this, but actually the facts are something else, but over the basic right of who controls access to what kinds of information. What kinds of information do citizens have a right to know about what the government is doing, for example, or what kinds of information should the government or corporations, for that matter, be stockpiling on citizens? And when, I was writing that book and discussing this concept of info politics, well before Snowden's revelations, but I sort of at the very end that was coming out as I was just finishing that book, and I do mention him in the conclusion, and I feel like that was sort of the beginning of a wider recognition of how important the control, who controls what information and who can keep what secret and how are, and now we have, of course, the rise of a lot of concerns about cybersecurity, which raise another aspect of this issue of the politics of control over information. And I kind of think of info politics as related to information in a similar way that I would think of land tenure versus land itself. Like you could be fighting over land itself, But then there are these larger land tenure systems that legitimate and authorize certain kinds of things and not others. And I feel like that's what I was trying to get at with infopolitics, that we have to think about the way that, powerful institutions and so on legitimate and delegitimate the circulation or access to certain kinds of information.
As a final question, we ask all of our guests to reflect on a concept that we're thinking through as part of this project, which is digital dignity. And I was wondering, in light of your work, your previous work, and also maybe your current work, what do you think digital dignity might or could mean?
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess I have to see this through the filter of the things that are currently foremost in my research agenda, in a way. But I feel like dignity implies some kind of self-possession and therefore a certain kind of power. And when I think about what that means in the digital context today, I have to relate it to people's ability or in actual lack thereof of having some control over their digital profile, over the digital data and the digital traces that they produce that are often collected and sold and circulated without people's awareness or really any control over that. So to me, digital dignity would first and foremost be rooted in some fundamental control over our digital lives, rather than having that basically under the control of a kind of corporate government partnership where all kinds of data are stockpiled about us and we don't even have access to it or control over what is done with it.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for that answer and all your other answers. It's been absolutely great having you on the podcast today.
Thanks so much, Ian.
What I really liked about Victoria's way of thinking was that she balanced her understanding of the transformative power of the internet with a critical, real-world understanding of politics and power. And one element that I'd like to highlight around this is the information, or infopolitics, as she calls it. You remember how she said that we can think about information, or how we should think about information, is similar to how we might want to think about land struggles. It's one thing to fight about land, and quite another to fight about land tenure. The other wider point that she made, and I think made very forcefully, is the global power of diaspora. One doesn't have to be of the diaspora to get digitally involved in another country's politics. This is what I realised when speaking with Rishi Bagri. As a proud Indian, he's very much involved in his country's politics, but he's also deeply involved in the global politics of the right. He sees similarities and is inspired to lend his considerable online support to movements elsewhere. Enough of me, let's hear from this week's online god, who goes by the Twitter handle at Rishi Bagri and signs off his profile as just an ordinary taxpaying Indian citizen. Thank you so much, Rishi, for joining us on Online Gods. We're really happy to have you here. I'm going to jump straight in. I want to ask you, why do you engage in debate online?
I don't know. It just happened. Actually, what happened in 2013, I just joined Twitter. There was some agitation going on against anti-corruption. If you remember, there was a tulip revolution in all over Middle East, and it also came to India in form of Anna Hazare agitation, India against corruption and all those things. So I went to social media just to check out what the latest things are happening, how people are reacting, how things are reacting, how everyone are reacting. I just was there as a silent observer to see the thing, basically. Mm-hmm. And I never used to react. 1 year I was just a silent, spectator. I just used to see the thing, and there were a lot of other hypocrisy which social media used to highlight. I mean, even of media. I mean, the media was very different for one section the media was using a different, what you call, rules for the other section of the society. And it was like going on. It was completely a politicization of the media, which is happening all over the world, because I was very actively engaged in the Trump campaign also in 2016. And I have seen this thing. Even the media everywhere has their own biasness, and they want to see what they want to impose their biasness to the people, and I think the people have rejected that biasness.
So you see basically social media as a way of calling out the bias in mainstream media?
Yeah, uh-huh. I think the social media has given the power to the ordinary people to challenge the media's hegemony. So that is the best part.
It's very interesting. But why do you think that you in particular have managed, I mean, I checked, you got like 63,000 people, more than 63,000 people follow you.
Not only 63,000, you see my impressions, is almost 20 million impressions per month, which is almost like one of the highest impression I'm having in this country. And impression is the most important, because I know a lot of people who have millions of followers, but when they tweet, they hardly get a 10 or 15 RTs, you know what I'm saying. So basically, those RTs have no issues. When I tweet, I get around about 400-500 RTs every single tweet. And I'm not boasting it, because people think that I'm a genuine person. I have no vested interest. I'm not politically connected. Although I'm supporting the ruling party right now, because I find that party to be less corrupt and better option is there. I mean, I find it to be in a better way, better situation. But that's the only way I support that party. That's all.
So you think that precisely because you are not somebody outside of Twitter that's a recognizable name, you think that's why people trust you?
Yeah, because the people can, they think that I'm one of their own. I mean, I'm one of the common person who is reflecting their views on the Twitter, and they are not like, I'm not a biased person. I'm not a person who is saying 98% chance is that Trump is going to lose and Hillary is going to win. I'm not saying that. I'm saying what I'm saying. I'm seeing the crowd of the Trump when I was following the Trump campaign. I was seeing that he was attracting huge lot of crowd, and vis-a-vis of Hillary Clinton. So I can easily figure out, any person can figure out that Trump is going to win. But the media till the last day was like, they were saying that no, it's not possible. Trump is not going to win, and it's not going to happen. And you know what the result was. Same happened in the Brexit. You are like, media is ignoring the silent majority, which is no more silent nowadays. And the silent majority has their own views, and they are not getting influenced by media. Media has lost that power of influencing the silent majority these days. Because of their biasness, I think, they are not able to call spade properly. They are very biased when it comes to one section of the society, and they become very liberal when it comes to the other section of society. So I think this has hurt the credibility of media a lot. And that's why the social media has come as an alternative, which is like, people assume and people think and people consider it to be a more honest than the media, which has their own axe to grind.
And it's really interesting to me that you got interested in the Trump campaign. Why? I mean, just before we started recording, we were speaking that you used to live in the UK, but as far as I know, you never lived in the USA. Correct me if I'm wrong. So what made you interested in, you know, American politics as well then?
No, actually, this guy was an outsider. So basically, he was not a politician. So it actually, and he was touching, he was talking about all the right things which American needed. And I was just seeing as a neutral person how this guy is shaping up his campaign. He was talking about the jobs. He was talking about the Rust Belt, about USA. He was talking about all the jobs which were shifting outside. He was talking all the right thing. He was talking about the security in the country. He was talking about he never wanted to be politically correct when it came to the, what you call, ISIS and other things. He wanted to cooperate with Russia regarding this mess which they have created in the Egypt and the Syria. And I think his foreign policy was far better than the foreign policy which was pursued by Hillary and Obama. He was very, he called Pakistan a terrorist country. Although I don't believe Pakistan is a terrorist, but yes, they do support terrorism. And he was very clear about some certain emigrants things. He was against illegal immigrants. He was against he was for the proper screening of the legal immigrant entering his country. So everything was like he was touching on the right things, which I was able to see in the social media. I can see what kind of people are basically what happened whenever a person tweets. I see the reactions. I see the tweets, subtweets, which gives me the perfect feel in the ground what exactly the people are thinking about the thing. Mm-hmm. So it helps me to shape up my views, what exactly the masses are thinking right now, not what media want me to believe what masses thinks.
That's really interesting. I'm just wondering, especially, you know, as an Indian yourself, and obviously there's a lot of Indians now in America, second generation, who are citizens and have the vote and so on. Do you think you can also influence the Indian diaspora in America? I mean, is there some sort of conversation going on?
When I was campaigning for Trump, basically I wanted Trump to win. So I was giving a lot of, tweeting a lot about Trump's, positive things about Trump's and all, everything. And I was getting a lot of traction from there, from the Indian diaspora staying in the USA. So I can feel that I was hitting on the right nerves, right part or right notes on the on their diaspora, because I was going for that. And I got a good response. If you analyze my Twitter handle, you will see 20-25% are from the USA subcontinent.
Wow. And do you analyze then your followers? You see where the people are and what sort of people they are? I mean, because you have so many followers, I'm wondering how do you do that?
A lot of people are like, they are like a salaried class and they are like well-educated class, because when I interact with them, because they give me the reaction on my tweet, so I can find out they are like a good, decent reaction which I'm getting, and the decent question, if they have any things, I mean, I can understand what kind of question they are putting through. So it helps me a lot to understand my kind of followers. So accordingly, I do keep on molding my tweets also. I keep on, rephrasing myself. I also quite, come back myself in the drawing room and try to make myself much better and much, evolved, you can say.
That's actually really interesting. I wondered, like, exactly, there's a certain art to writing a good tweet, right? I mean, what is it? I mean, I just wondered, like, how do you manage to craft something which gets traction?
Basically, the thing is that you have to write in a very simple language, because the if you want your tweet to go to if you want a lot of people to read your tweet, it had to be in a very plain, simple language with bullet points and everything. So at least the point wise should be there. A person can understand. You can squeeze a lot of data in 140 letters so that a person can understand nicely what exactly I want to convey.
Mm-hmm. And you think, I'm just wondering, like, and are you, because when I look for your tweets, you're very, you've got the skill of responding to people in a very sharp way that sort of like turns the conversation and so on. I mean, recently now there's a debate going on about standing for the national anthem or so on. And so you managed to capture something in a very, in this very short way. And I'm wondering, is this something that you also have in other parts of your life, like in offline interactions? You're also this sort of, sharp or witty person, or it's something which you really comes out for you when you're online?
No, basically I don't snap on the person, witty one-liners are mainly reserved for the social media. You can't use it in the in front of the friends, because there I'm a neutral person. On the social media, I'm a different person altogether. I'm a neutral person. I'm a faceless person. I have to be very careful what I'm tweeting, because people are judging me.
Mm-hmm. So you feel that, like, so offline when you meet people, they talk about the sort of things that you're tweeting online?
No, most of my friends doesn't know I exist online, basically.
Wow. So you have like a parallel life.
Yeah, sort of. But now with the advent of social media, like a lot of people knows I am online, but I don't care. I mean, that's okay. That is a different thing. Someone comes to me today. I was having a dinner in a restaurant. Another person came to me. I follow you in the Twitter. You don't know me. I don't know you, but it's nice that you follow me. So any advice you want me to give So he have his own set. You should talk about this. You should also cover this subject. You should always, since you when you tweet, a lot of people follows you. All the ministers follows you. Your PM follows you. Your party, the BJP's party leader, is following you. His president is following. So you are followed by a lot of influential persons. So your tweet makes sense. So that makes me more responsible. I should not tweet something which, like, it creates something, a bad impression about anything. So I'm very responsible in tweeting myself, and I make sure that this happens. What I want to say, that power of social media is rising exponentially, and the old age media is crumbling. You know, well, won't be watching news, I think.
Then I mean, I also feel this is, there's something really happening, right, powerful in social media. But then when I think about it a little bit, I sometimes wonder, do not then people sort of split into their camps and listen to people they want to listen to, right? Because if I sit down and watch the BBC, or if you sit down and watch, what's your favorite Indian TV channel? Like, I don't know, like whatever one you're watching, NDTV or whatever.
When I'm into Twitter, basically, I don't watch TV channels because I already have all the informations on the Twitter. And so the TV channel's information has become a stale news for me because it's already there in the Twitter 2 hours earlier. So you have to understand this thing. The information is getting stale by the time it comes at the prime time in the TV and the next day in the newspaper. The newspaper channels, the newspaper information is completely, like, you know, stale.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but then, do you follow people, or do you hear news from people who have quite different views from your own? Like the sort of, you know, liberal left crowd. Do you also follow those on Twitter and see what they have to say?
I do follow the Twitter for the liberal left crowd. Everything is happening. I'm seeing that. And they are like, the thing with the liberal left is that they have become hypocritical in their nature. Why I'm saying that? Because they are not able to call spade and to a spade. And that is the reason why right wing people are rising, because left wing people are conceding the space to them. I'm very responsible on what I'm saying. It's the left liberal who are giving them the space. That's the reason why RW is rising all over the world. If you see, this is a global phenomena. This is not a country-specific phenomena. Now, even if the Germany election happens, there's a good chance that the right-wing parties will rise this year.
And do you think then you're able to influence people of a different political persuasion from yourself? I mean, are you speaking to the converted, to the converted, Ava?
I don't believe in converting anyone. I just show them the hypocrisy. Look, this guy was saying this when this happened to you. This guy was saying this thing when this happened to Mr. X. This guy, his reaction is completely different. So you can see the hypocrisy, and now you can go and confront him. That's all. When a black get attacked, there's a different kind of uproar. When a white get attacked, there's a different kind of uproar. When a Muslim get attacked in India, there's a different kind of uproar. When a Hindu guy get attacked, there's a different kind of uproar. You can't have a selective approach to every crime. You have to have a unanimous fixed standard. A murder is murder, whether it's black or white, or Hindu or Muslim, Christian or Islamic. The murder is murder. You have to condemn that murder. You cannot have a weightages. You try to understand. A crime is a crime. If a rape happened by a migrant, it's a crime. You cannot ignore the migrant crime. You cannot do that. If you start ignoring it, then Brexit is going to happen. Then the Trump is going to happen. Then a lot of things are going to happen.
And so then I'm just thinking, like, in terms of then how you see yourself, you're saying you point out hypocrisies. You basically see yourself then as a corrective to the mainstream media, or you think eventually people like yourself will completely take over and be the primary place that people go to for news?
No, basically, I don't want media space to get, I don't want them to become a dinosaur. Basically, they need to change. That's what I want them to. This is not my full-time job. I have a business to run. I am into investments. I have my own work. I hardly able to give that much of time which I'm giving right now. But what I mean to say, the media need to correct itself. The media need to correct its double face. What I mean to say, they need to correct itself so that the people can start trusting media. Rather, the distrust is so high. If media is going to, I'm still telling you, if media is going to tell them that you vote for Hillary and not for Trump, people will vote for Trump. This is the amount of distrust. They are directly, inversely related to media right now.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the media is going to tell, they are going to do the opposite. This is the level of distrust they are having in media. They know if media is saying this, then it had to be false.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. So basically, there's been a complete erosion in trust in the mainstream media and people
don't
like
you. Don't you think that?
Yes, I think so, of course. I think most people believe this for sure. I'm just what's interesting for me is that is the role that social media can play in bringing back trust to, you know, mainstream media. I mean, what's really interesting is that you have people like yourself from the right and also from the left basically attacking mainstream media, and mainstream media at the moment doesn't have a response to this, right? They don't know where they're going to go. And this is what's really interesting, because they have to somehow rebuild trust amongst people. You know? Are they going to be, you know, are people going to start to trust newspapers and TV channels again? But so maybe for my last question, because one of the, I suppose one of the interesting things that people say about, you know, debate that takes place on Facebook, on Twitter and so on, is that very often it's quite aggressive or angry and so on. And do you think there's a possibility for, you know, dignified debates to take place, you know, online?
Basically, I believe in dignified debate, because the thing is that if you abuse a person, you will lose your respect. People will start unfollowing you, because nobody wants to follow a person who keep on abusing a person. So basically, I don't believe in abusing. And there's a mechanism built in the social media. If somebody is abusing you, you can mute him, you can block that person, you can do whatever. Instead of crying foul, this is social media. This is a different ball game. This is if you go to a rugby, you are tend to jostle around. This is not a cricket game. This is not a gentleman's game. You are on Twitter, you have to face the brand. If you speak stupid, then you will get a sharp reactions. So you have to be careful what you're speaking, basically. And secondly, what I mean to say, you have to be dignified if you want to have a good traction. This is what I have seen. So if you scan my tweet, I might be having a one, I don't know how many tweets, but you won't find a word of abuse. I mean, you will hardly find any abuse or anything which goes against me. That is the reason why I've been followed by a lot of good people and a lot of influential people. So I don't believe in abuse, and I tell my followers also, please don't abuse anyone. Rather, you just have to be factual in your approach. Just show him the facts. You were wrong at this place. If you are tweeting something wrong, just show him the fact. This is the fact. This is not the word. What you are saying is the right thing.
And then what about how do then people respond to stuff like that? I mean, people sometimes must respond to you in quite aggressive or undignified ways. Does it hurt? Does it hurt when people do this?
If somebody abuse me, I simply block. That's all. I don't abuse him back, because that's not my style of doing the things. If I go and wrestle with the pig, there will be no difference between me and the pig. So I don't want to. I have shaped my profile in that way that I don't stoop to that low level. So basically, the thing is that I believe in. If somebody abuse me, I just simply mute or block. I mean, depending on his stitcher or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't respond.
But it doesn't upset.
But it doesn't upset. In a sarcastic manner. My weapon is sarcasm.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Yeah, I've noticed this from your tweets. You are a sarcastic guy. But doesn't it hurt you at all? Like, because people can be brutal.
No? It hardly makes any difference. I don't know that person. He doesn't know me. I am a faceless person. That person is a faceless. A faceless person is abusing another faceless person. Hardly makes any difference to me.
Okay. Well, wonderful. Thank you so much, Rishi, for coming on the podcast. It's been really great to speak to you today.
Yeah, same to you. Have a nice day.
What's amazing when you listen to Rishi speak is his sense of his own power to shape the online debate. It was also really interesting to hear him talking about how he listens to the online mood, claiming not only that he can read it in a way that reveals the public's mood, but also that it's so much more timely than traditional media. He considers 2 hours as already being old hat. Well, that's it from us for today. Just a couple more things to mention before we leave. First is, I want to remind you of all the ways that you can get in touch. You can tweet us at for the letter Digital Dignity. You can check the project's website at fordigitaldignity.com. You can send me an email, onlinegodspodcast@gmail.com. And of course, you can also leave comments on iTunes or whatever other podcast library service you use. And thanks so much for those who got in touch about last week's podcast. I want to read out one letter, or email rather, letter, a podcast about digital politics, and we're talking about letters. Anyway, I want to read out one email by Pushpendra Johar, who actually publicly wrote about the podcast on the email list Anthropology Matters, which I'm sure those of you who aren't actually anthropologists won't be aware of. He wrote, "Thank you for the interviews, especially the one with Roundtable India's founder editor, Kufir Nalgundwar. It's always refreshing to listen to Kufir. I also like the kind of questions that were raised. Just a thought about the title of the podcast, Dalit Online Media. My understanding of a platform like Roundtable India is that they are anti-caste in their philosophy and may not identify only as a Dalit space. Rather, they break away from that kind of exclusivity. As Kufir Nalgundwar mentioned in his interview, caste doesn't only mean Dalit or untouchability, and it includes everyone who is part of caste society. Thus, it feels a little inadequate reading a title, especially when the interviewee himself takes a different stand on such kind of identification." Well, I wrote back to him publicly as well, so I'll read my reply. "Thanks for raising it about the title and also raising it publicly, as I think how we anthropologists name what we co-produce and publish is important. On the one hand, I was trying to give the podcast a title that people would understand, including those who are not so familiar with the Indian context. On the other, I was trying to be both descriptive and true to how Roundtable India identify themselves. In their About section, they write they're a platform for Dalit voices, a resource for young Dalits, and a tool for Dalits to interact. As such, I felt that Dalit Online Media was an appropriate title." And then Pushpendra wrote back, which is very kind of him. Now, he says, "I have mostly read the founders and editors of Roundtable India using Dalit Bahojans or simply Bahojans while referring to the disenfranchised people, of course, depending upon what the question is, and their politics as anti-caste politics. That's how I understand it. The purpose of sharing this concern on the mailing list was for the same reason you mentioned, that we question why we choose a particular term slash usage over others in the academic knowledge production domain, which quite clearly is homogenized by, again, a handful of castes in the South Asian context. My concern arises from the fact that terms like Dalit, Pariah, Untouchables have come to acquire a particular kind of commodity value for the ones who have the means and power to represent the other. And it is a recurring concern for a lot of us who are directly impacted by it and who are probably the first or second generations who have been formally educated people from our entire clans. That's also the reason why it becomes extremely significant to raise issues around typology, representation, and appropriation on a platform which constantly engages with such research interests. I'm not implying that this was the case with the title of the podcast. I've already stated in your email. I am just sharing the concerns." Well, that's it from me today. Thank you so much for listening. I've been your host, Ian Cook, and I hope you listen again next time. Thank you so much for listening to the Online Gods podcast. Online Gods is part of the project Online ARPOL, funded by the European Research Council Starting Grant Agreement number 714285. The project's PI is Sahana Udupa, who's Professor of Media Anthropology at the Department of Social and Cultural Anthropology, Ludwig Maximilian University, Munich, Germany. This podcast, like all the podcasts, is brought to you in collaboration with the HOW Network for Ethnographic Theory, my personal favourite network for ethnographic theory. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Goodbye.